From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Dr. Paul Gould, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Palm Beach Atlantic University and author of A Good and True Story, 11 Clues to Understanding Our Universe and Your Place in It. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Paul Gould in their conversation.
You make another bold claim, and that is the claim that there's no such thing as pointless evil. I think this is a really important point.
Right. So if the logical problem of evil has been solved, let's say, almost everybody agrees. There's at least two atheistic philosophers I know that think that Plantinga and others didn't solve the logical problem, but most, including William Rowe, Paul Draper, who I interact with in the chapter, others say, no, we solved the logical problem. Let's move on to what's called the evidential problem. The evidential problem just says, given all this evil, probably God doesn't exist, because for all we can tell, much of the evil and suffering we see in the world is completely pointless. Now, there are some theists, like Peter Van Inwagen, that will agree and say, yeah, there is some pointless evil in the world. But most theists are not willing to go there, and I don't want to go there either. Your listeners might not want all this detail, but I agree with Eleanor Stump, who's a wonderful philosopher, who she has a high bar for theodicies. Theodicies are giving God justifying reasons for evil. She has what's called a person-centric bar, such that the evil and suffering that happens to you must be for your benefit, not for humanity in general, not for some other creature, but for the person undergoing the suffering. That's a very high bar for giving a reason for God allowing evil. And Stump's answer then, given that high bar, which is one that I'm super attracted to, is that the only reasons why God allows evil and suffering in any person's life is for one of two reasons. Number one, either to prevent that person from further distancing themselves from God, their highest good, or number two, to draw them closer to their highest good, which is God. And those are the only two, basically, two reasons for allowing evil. And I'm really attracted to that view. And one of the reasons why this view works and only works is because you have to extend the God-justifying reasons into the afterlife, right? I think that Tolkien's insight at the end of The Lord of the Rings, when Sam, you know, and Frodo are back at the Shire, and Sam's like, why are you leaving? He's going off to the Grey Havens. And Frodo says, you know, hey, there's some wounds that time cannot heal, right? The intuition is that some of our wounds in this world, I don't think will totally heal, but in the afterlife, right, all of those things will be made right again. And I'm pretty attracted to that view. I don't know how I got here from your question, but that's where I'll stop.
No, it's a good answer. I was thinking as you're speaking, I just quoted this at a wedding of one of my daughters last weekend. It's called The Weaver. I was in a restaurant in Southern California, and I saw this placemat in a Coco's, actually. And it had this little poem, and I decided to memorize it. And I've used it many times, but I think it sort of explains what we're talking about. It goes something like this. My life is but a weaving between my Lord and me. I do not choose the colors. He weaveth steadily. Oft times he weaveth sorrow, and I in foolish pride. Forget he sees the upper, and I the underside. Not till the loom is silent and the shuttles cease to fly will God unfurl the canvas and explain the reason why. The dark threads are as needful in the weaver's skillful hand as the threads of gold and silver in the pattern he has planned. So suffering really has significant impact in our lives. I mean, suffering, we can say credibly, God uses suffering for good.
Yeah, right. And part of the thing, this is one of the, there's a number of places in the book where I'm sharing a little bit more personal about my story, but I share a time when I actually experienced a great loss in my own life. And I actually was reading Eleanor Stump, this person I just mentioned, her book, Wandering in Darkness, and she named it. And it was heartbreak. And so here I was, a philosophy professor who's taught for decades on the problem of evil, but I didn't know what heartbreak was. And suddenly I'm at this place where I have this feeling at the level of my gut that this is what it means to be broken and stripped of a deep longing of the heart, actually. And then I had like different eyes to see. You're right. Like suddenly I'm in the grocery store, I'm at the restaurant, and I'm looking around at the faces. I'm like, oh, there's heartbreak over there. And there it is there. And so it's actually helped me. You're right. So going through this suffering in my own life, not embarrassed to say, but my life has been pretty easy. But going through that period of suffering gave me eyes to see and to really appreciate the importance of wrestling with this and that God is good even there. Yeah.
You have a chapter. I love this chapter, chapter 9. It's simply titled Love. What is love?
This is one of my favorite chapters. Actually, the love and beauty one, we're finally getting to the beauty that I just really loved writing. Okay, so what is love and why include it? Well, it seems to be something that we think is of great value. And I love what I was really struck by, I've been reading on the virtues for years, and I was reading Joseph Pieper, who's a Catholic theologian, philosopher who writes on the virtues, and I was reading his chapter on love. And he has this wonderful little sentence where he says the fundamental affirmation of love is I'm glad that you exist. I'm glad that you are. And I can remember reading that for the first time thinking, that's right. That's profound. And that's right. That's what love's fundamental affirmation is. And so I wanted to explore this. This is like, you know, in a work on apologetics or cultural apologetics, we don't usually think about the argument from love to God, but there is one. And so what I did is spent some time looking at the nature of love. And then I asked, what is the best explanation for this deep love that we do see in the world? What is love? Well, it has at least 5 features that we notice. It's multi-directed, right? We can love things and food and people. It's complex. It's deep and enduring. It's active and passive. And of course, it's of deep value. And so then the question was, what best explains those features of love? And I had a chance to look at the contemporary literature. And there's actually a rich tradition of philosophy of love. And I canvassed those only to discover that Aquinas, the 13th century monk, celibate monk, probably got it right. And for Aquinas, I'm convinced that this is the best account of love that I've found. Love is the desire for 2 things. Love is the desire for the well-being of the beloved and union with the beloved. And that seems to capture the phenomenology, the features of love that I experience in my own life and that I think others experience in theirs as well.
You point out that if you take the non-religious story, love comes into the picture very late in the game. I mean, I suppose that's true of Islam as well. For Islam, you have a Unitarian God. A Unitarian God doesn't have an object apart from the universe to love, and therefore is morally deficient, doesn't have the attribute of love. But in either case, if we just go to the naturalistic worldview, love comes into the picture late.
Yeah, right. It's not fundamental to reality. It's late and it's local for all we know. You know, it's in one place. And so then what's interesting is you can run an argument from the kind of deep love that I articulate there, that's basically Aquinas's view, to theism. And it goes something like this. It's very simple in the book, you know, hey, given naturalism, this kind of love is really surprising. Right? Because it's late and local, and it's like an evolutionary byproduct of survival. But on theism, it's not surprising. Therefore, according to a rule of inference called the likelihood principle, the existence of love provides strong evidence for the existence of theism. So why is love not surprising on theism? Well, on the Christian story, love is at the center of reality itself, right? Like I love your point. I hadn't actually thought about that with the Unitarian God of Islam versus the Trinitarian God of Christianity. At the heart of the Trinitarian God is love, right? This is the most fundamental fact of reality. It's a relational fact, and it's a fact about love. And so it wouldn't be surprising, given that fundamental reality is love itself, that this loving being would create a universe with creatures that can love. And that's actually a piece of evidence that can figure into a pretty cool argument from love to the God of theism.
Yeah, maybe this is regressing a little bit in terms of the book, but I think it's important to the overall structure of the book. Explain your use of conceptual landscapes.
Well, I think that it goes back to something that J.P. Moreland, my first philosophy professor, drilled into my mind, and my students who I teach now will recognize this comment. But J.P. said, if you want to be good thinkers, you need to learn to make distinctions. And if you want to be good teachers, you need to learn to teach distinctions. And that has been something that I have followed for years. I think that it's important to ask the right preliminary questions and get clear on the concepts that we're talking about, because by the light of reason, we shine our light on reality and we discover truth. And if we're after discovering the true story of the world, we have to think as carefully and as clearly and as methodically as we can. And this is a skill that we've lost. So that's why I try to do a bunch of, you know, conceptual landscape kind of work all throughout the book. And I try to do it, I will say, with some humor and with some stories along the way. But it's super important that we think clearly about these important matters.
Your chapter on beauty, loved it. Why do you think that beauty is ultimately objective? Some people would say that's ridiculous. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. You say, no, that's not true.
Yeah. Well, because we need to look at the phenomena and ask what best explains the phenomena. And for at least, well, two reasons that are coming to mind. There's many. Number one, we disagree about beautiful things, and that the fact that we have disagreements and that we think people are wrong is best explained by there being objective aesthetic facts in the world. So that's one reason, and I could give an argument for that.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor Paul Gould. In his book, A Good and True Story, philosopher Paul Gould guides you on a rewarding journey to discover the true story of the world and our place in it, showing that Christianity holds the most satisfying answers to life's biggest questions. A Good and True Story is a wonderful book to give to an unbelieving friend or family member. To receive your copy of A Good and True Story, 11 Clues to Understanding Our Universe and Your Place in It, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Breaking the code of the Book of Revelation has become an international obsession. The result has been rampant misreading of Scripture, bad theology, and even bad politics and foreign policy. In the Apocalypse Code, find out what the Bible really says about the end times and why it matters today. Hank Hanegraaff argues that the key to understanding the last book of the Bible is the other 65 books of the Bible, not current events or recent history. The Apocalypse Code offers sane answers to some very controversial questions, such as, what does it mean to take the book of Revelation literally? Who are the Antichrist and the Great Whore of Babylon? And what is the real meaning of 666? Order The Apocalypse Code by Hank Hanegraaff today. Available in softcover, MP3 CD, or MP3 download from equip.org. Or call 888-7000-CRI. Anyone who's been paying attention knows there's a war going on, not just on traditional morality, civility, and decency, but even more fundamentally on historic notions of truth. And the enemy isn't just the onslaught of fake news facilitated by a post-truth culture and turbocharged by growing legions of ideological spin doctors. No, the real enemies of truth range from postmodernist convictions that there is no objective truth to militant scientism that claims that only science can determine truth, and religion is little more than primitive superstitions. But CRI support team members are not waving a white flag of surrender. They're holding the fort by undergirding every one of Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping and life-changing outreaches 24/7. To learn how you can make a difference and enjoy all the benefits of support team membership, simply visit equip.org.
Hank Hanegraaff has dedicated his life to defending truth because truth matters. However, his life and ministry were radically transformed by another three-word phrase, life matters more. Truth matters because Christianity is rooted in history and evidence. Life matters more because it is the experience of union with God. The goal of Christian life is union with God. All attempts to understand Christianity from a solely rational perspective put us in danger of devolving into a transactional rather than transformational relationship with God. Truth Matters, Life Matters More will equip you to move beyond intellectually knowing about God to experientially knowing Him in Christ. To receive your copy of Truth Matters, Life Matters More, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI, or visit us online at equip.org.
Let's rejoin Bible Answer Man host Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, philosopher Paul Gould, in their conversation.
Why do you think that beauty is ultimately objective?
Two reasons that are coming to mind. There's many. Number one, we disagree about beautiful things, and that the fact that we have disagreements and that we think people are wrong is best explained by there being objective aesthetic facts in the world. So that's one reason, and I could give an argument for that. One thing that I found really interesting, though, because I've been working a little bit on philosophy of science and thinking about theory construction and metaphysics, which is the area I work in philosophy. And what's so interesting, when you're doing your mature theories, like in metaphysics or in science, you appeal to theoretical virtues, because theoretical virtues are supposed to be truth indicative, right? So if your theory has more virtues than some competing theory, well, then you go with the one with the most virtues, because those virtues are truth indicative. What's so interesting is the theoretical virtues are all aesthetic, simplicity, elegance, uniformity, right? Scope. These are all aesthetic things. And many thinkers have noticed throughout history that truth and beauty are tightly aligned. In fact, in our theory assessment, truth and beauty are tightly aligned. There's an argument from the indispensability of aesthetic properties to the objective existence of aesthetic facts. So those are just two reasons. I think it's like looking at the sunset. Wouldn't that be foolish to say, oh, that's just beautiful to you, right? Looking at, yeah, I live in Jupiter, Florida. It's like paradise. Looking at the palm tree outside my window, right? We would think that they are wrong if they look at these things and think they're not actually objectively beautiful.
Yeah, so one of the quotes you use, I love this, Peter Forrest, I just laughed out loud when I read this. He presses the implausible consequence of aesthetic relativism, or saying, well, beauty is just in the eye of the beholder. And this is the quote, it's worth reading. How ugly the stars are tonight. How trivial the pounding of the waves on the beach. And is it not crass to be thrilled by mountains? The rainforest and the wildflowers are quite repulsive. And as for sunsets and .. You read that quote and you say, yeah, beauty is not just in the eyes of the beholder. There is objective beauty.
Yeah. So then the question becomes, what do we do with that fact, right? So now notice what's happening to our universe. We began with physical facts, looking at the universe, Lady Nature. Then we started looking at like moral facts and meaning facts. And now we're looking at aesthetic facts. Suddenly our universe is quite interesting, right? There's all these features of the world that are way more rich than the scientific view of the world sometimes tells us on the non-religious story. So again, we ask what best explains it. And you can run the very same kind of argument that I ran in the argument from love. I look at two specific features of objective beauty in the world and argue on theism, they're best explained, and naturalism, they're utterly surprising. And those two features are, number one, that the world is saturated with beauty. From the heavens above to the microscopic below, everywhere we turn our mind's eye, including the laws of nature itself, we find beauty, right? It's saturated. Now, think of the analogy with an artist, a human artist. A human artist can create beautiful things. Because of my research on beauty, I'm trying to learn how to draw, because I want to learn to see the world. And I think that that will help me to learn to see the world better, maybe, if I can develop some art. And I know, because I'm really bad at it, that it's hard to create beautiful portraits, landscapes, right? But an artist can do that. If nature and natural processes are all that there is in the universe, you wouldn't expect the universe to be saturated with beauty, because it's hard to create beauty. You'd expect it in maybe, you know, get lucky in different pockets of the world maybe, or something like that, but it's saturated. That's one piece of evidence. The second piece of evidence is what philosophers, theologians, and sociologists have noted throughout history, including atheists, is that beauty has a kind of transcendent quality to it. It's evocative of the eternal, as one would put it. From Plato on, they've noticed this. And even the atheist says, given this evocative nature, the universe is kind of a sham, right? So you want to take these two facts, the fact that the world is saturated with beauty and the fact that it's suggestive of like a kind of personal communication, a transcendent nature to it. What best explains that? Well, on naturalism, again, that would be surprising. On theism, given God himself is the source of beauty, or beauty itself, it's not surprising. So beauty, as it turns out, is another powerful reason to think that God exists.
You've already touched on this, but maybe to elaborate on this a little more, even when you talk about how you've started to draw, because it gives you a concept, an understanding of the world, the beauty of the world, and that leads you to the religious story or the Christian worldview. What is the chief value of art? And why is it so important that art remains art and doesn't become random and distorted?
I love this. I taught a class here at PBA on philosophy and literature, but it was really our philosophy of art class and for part of that. And we read Gordon Graham's book, Philosophy, Introduction to Philosophy of the Arts. And in there, and I talk about this in the book we're talking about, Good and True Story, I talk about these different theories. I'm convinced the view that it's called aesthetic cognitivism, but it's just the view that the chief value of art is cognitive. And what he means, the chief value of art is it helps us understand the world around us or the human experience of the world. That's what art does. It's kind of like, and this is what I love about artists, and I think philosophers can play this role too. Artists are men and women who basically pull that curtain back on reality and help us get a glimpse, I think, of prime reality the way that it really is, right? That's the benefit of art. You could even give like an eschatological function or telos to art. That good art, I think, helps us see what reality one day in the transformed, renewed heavens and earth will be like. That's what art does. It's evocative of the divine, but it helps us to see, understand, and appreciate reality. And ultimately, I think, done well, it can lead us to worship.
Yeah, and as you just alluded to, it points us to the divine artist.
That's right. Yeah.
Religion, your last chapter, fantastic chapter. I mean, the book just keeps getting better as you go through it. And I hope we've done justice to the book, because when you read it, it's just intoxicating. You can't stop reading it because you tell wonderful stories and you just have a gift for doing this. But how do you define religion?
Good. Yeah. Good. I thought in any book seeking to discover the true story of the world, we should talk about the thing that the majority of humans in the history of our species have engaged in, which is religious activities. Religiare is the Latin word to bind. And so religion is seeking to unite heaven and earth, God and man. And that's, you know, in generic terms, what religion is. And this chapter, actually, you know, I have guides in the book along the way. I'm inviting guides to kind of help point us in the right direction. In this last chapter, this is the most personal, where I share some of my own journey coming to faith in Christ and just kind of share a little bit about that. But yeah, so it begins with all the religions can't be true because they contradict each other, right? I feel like I thought that it would be important to state that, because that moves away from this sort of false idea that's out there sometimes that all religions are equal paths to God, right? I think we need to move beyond that to discover the true story of the world, the true religion that God founded. And that moves us off of that purely logical blunder that all religions are the same to the question of evidence. And so I just share briefly the evidence that was persuasive to me as a freshman in college was, among other things, the evidence for the resurrection. And I just briefly go into it there, more sharing my biography than the actual evidence, but I'm pointing the reader to it and helping them see that all the clues that we've been exploring, all of them converge on this good, well, this true story, and it turns out to be a good story. And if you go all the way back to the book I wrote, Cultural Apologetics, my definition of cultural apologetics was that we want to help others see that Christianity is not just true to the way the world is, but it's true to the way the world ought to be, that it's both good and beautiful and true, right? And that's what I wanted to end with, was not only did we discover the true story, but it satisfies all the longings of the heart in a way that's, we discover our true name. And as it turns out, that true name, and this is where I end, is Beloved on the Christian story.
Expand on something that you just touched on very briefly. I think it's worth expanding on the idea that all religions can be false, but they can't all be true.
Good. Yeah, this is just a point of logic. Given the law of non-contradiction, two mutually exclusive statements cannot be true at the same time in the same sense, right? So if we just take two religions and boil it down to a set of propositions that they claim, within the Christian faith, you would find a proposition affirmed that Jesus is God or divine. And within like the Islamic faith, you would have a proposition that's the negation of that. Jesus is not divine, right? So just on a pure logical point, one of those statements is true and the other is false. Either Jesus is or isn't divine, right? And so if that's a central claim that is like at the foundation of these religions, well, it just follows that either Christianity is true or Islam is true, but not both. And you're right, all of the religions could be false. It could be some other thing out there that we haven't determined, but they can't all be true because they contradict each other on these central features about the nature of reality, the nature of God, man's fundamental problem, and God's solution.
Thank you for listening to this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, philosopher Paul Gould. To hear this Hank Unplugged podcast interview in its entirety, go to equip.org, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Our firm commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you a copy of A Good and True Story, 11 Clues to Understanding Our Universe and Your Place in It by Dr. Paul Gould. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters. Life matters more. Breaking the code of the Book of Revelation has become an international obsession. The result has been rampant misreading of Scripture, bad theology, and even bad politics and foreign policy. In the Apocalypse Code, find out what the Bible really says about the end times and why it matters today. Hank Hanegraaff argues that the key to understanding the last book of the Bible is the other 65 books of the Bible, not current events or recent history. The Apocalypse Code offers sane answers to some very controversial questions, such as, what does it mean to take the book of Revelation literally? Who are the Antichrist and the Great Whore of Babylon? And what is the real meaning of 666? Order the Apocalypse Code by Hank Hanegraaff today. Available in softcover, MP3 CD, or MP3 download from equip.org. Or call 888-7000-CRI.